This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation, hubba, 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 money, 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 who do you trust? Me and Kelly, we're giving you a free podcast. But where is the Batman? He's in the second half, washing his tights. Yes, I promise there will probably be way more Jack Nicholson impressions in this episode than you ever wanted to hear. Especially coming from me, and whenever you know there are other people in the Place to Be Nation pop family who do it better. But that's not going to stop me, because that's what I'm here for. Now, as you guys know, this episode is going to be a new segment for Seller's Points. For episode 9, we are introducing the brand new Guide 2 episode. That's right, in the second half, you will be getting a Guide 2 everybody's favorite Cape Crusader, the Dark Knight himself, Batman. Now, that was voted on Twitter, as I put it to the people, to choose who the first Guide 2 episode would be about. And you, the people, have spoken, and Batman is the winner. But that just means we're getting him out of the way first, right? Right. Okay. But before we get to that, we got a regular show to do, and we know you guys come here to hear all about some comics and some comic book news. And joining me on this episode, as always, the illustrious, the sensual, the, as always, ginger Barry White, Mr. Kelly Poole. What's up, sir?
Not much. How's it going, everybody? Another day. Much.
But we came to hear those smooth, dulcet tones. And there they were, folks. There will be more coming in later on this episode. So, with that, we got some comics to talk, don't we, Kelly?
Yes, we do.
Yes, we do. And as always, we like to kick things off by looking back at the last 2 weeks' worth of comics and picking out our favorite two books. And two books that maybe didn't quite hit the mark for us. So, I know what Kelly has got on his list, and you guys are going to learn about both of them now. So let's start with you, Kelly, because you've got some interesting picks in your top two. So tell us what was your first top pick?
My first top pick was Archie Comics, Josie and the Pussycats, number one.
Wow.
Yeah, it's I'm going to make another reference to the 70s. I think I've been doing this most. I think every episode that I've been on so far, I've made a reference to the 70s. Cartoon-wise, I mean, we had Scooby-Doo and stuff like that, but they also did a Josie and the Pussycat cartoon back when I was little. And it was just one of those cartoons like Scooby-Doo I watched and liked and had, I guess, what you would call my first cartoon crush was on Josie because she had red hair. And back in the day, there wasn't a whole lot of – I mean, yeah, we had Daphne. She was dumb and and really didn't really, you know, give a good light to redheads. And for those fans of Daphne out there, I'm sorry.
What about Wilma?
Yeah, that's true. Wilma, I mean, I really wasn't a Flintstones watcher, but yeah, that's true.
You're comic, far more of a Betty guy, I think.
Yeah, well, I really wasn't a Flintstones person at all. I mean, no offense to the Flintstone fans out there, but I never really, it wasn't, yeah, I watched the cartoon when it came on, but it was really like I just watched it because there was nothing else to do. You know, there wasn't anything else on. This version of Josie and the Pussycats is obviously a little bit more up to date. The lingo's, you know, current with the way the kids speak and so forth. But it was just a fun book. It was just really, you know, when I saw it listed in previews, I was like, oh, man, really? Well, this is cool. I guess I'll have to check that out. So I had it put on my pull list. And I wasn't disappointed. I mean, it was one of the books I read last week, and the characters are all really done well and kind of a little bit different than how, I mean, you know, they were kind of originally, created. But like I said, it's a nice little bump to the modern era of these three women and these three girls, I guess. But I mean, it's definitely a good book. It was fun. I enjoyed it. My other top pick was Nova number 11, which is the last issue of the current run. You know, I haven't really said a whole lot about Nova, but Nova has been one of the better Marvel books that I've been reading, along with, like, you know, Squadron Supreme for the most part and Visions. Nova was really, I mean, this last issue, they really pulled a lot of stops out, and an old friend kind of showed back up in this issue in the form of the World Mind, which is basically the power center for and the knowledge center for the Nova Corps, and happened to be Richard Rider was inhabiting his body, the World Mind was. So it was neat to see Richard and Sam dialogue and kind of talk shop to an extent. And it was just an all-around really good issue. And, I mean, there at the end, Richard actually shows up back on Earth in he goes home and visits his mom. That's the last panel. And we've been teased with the helmet logo, I guess a few months back, or a couple of months back maybe, that we may be seeing him again come back and put the helmet on and be Nova.
That does seem to be the big tease for the next volume of Nova that's going to be starting up, I think, like within a month or so. And that's really cool that they're going to have, and it's going to be a team-up book between what now we have all, I guess, seen is going to be Richard Rider and Sam. So that's,
which I think it's that's a good pairing. I mean, you've got the whole kind of old and new. And if you haven't read any of the Nova series that started it all back in the I think the late 70s, mid 70s, if you could pick up like an Essentials of Nova, I don't even know if they still print those, but I mean, it's pretty cheap. It's like 15 to 19 bucks, but you get pretty much the Essentials were all. You get the entire series. Now, it's black and white, but it's on the cheap for those that, you know, kind of trying to be frugal.
Or if you have access to a tablet or your smartphone, you can also plug yourself into Marvel Unlimited for $69.99 a year, and you will have access to the entire Nova back catalog. And there is some tremendous stuff in there. Lots of good reading. So that is well worth your time and your money. And those are two excellent picks for the week. But I've got...
The Green Lantern books that came out this week, excellent too. But
These were the books that hit with you, and I got a couple that definitely hit with me as well. And I'm going to start with what I think is going to go down as not just one of the best Superman comics ever written, but one of the single best comics, period, ever put to page. and that is Superman number 7 from Peter Tomasi, Patrick Gleason, and George Jimenez. This is a an interlude chapter. It's kind of a little stinger at the end of a story arc, and it's just a family day out at the fair. But of course, you get to see all these amazing family dynamics between Clark, Lois, and John. And this creative team just knocks that out of the park. They totally get how to write a family as a like living, breathing thing. They put so many fun moments throughout the entire issue. And every bit of it feels genuine. It feels heartfelt. This is the evolution of Superman that we've always wanted to see. And it's just so much fun reading a family dynamic book like this featuring the Man of Steel. And, I mean, it's a book that really feels like coming home again. That's the best way I could describe it, was it felt like coming home again. And when you get to the end of it, that last panel is one of the best things I've ever seen in a Superman comic. It just screams, this is Superman. That's what it is. Like you see him in every great facet of who he is in the modern era. And this is just a book that everybody should be reading. I don't know how anybody could get into DC Rebirth and not be reading Superman. It is simply the best thing that DC Comics is publishing today. But it's not the only book I enjoyed. There was another one. And that would be Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 5.
Nice.
This was from, of course, Robert Venditti and the incomparable, the absolutely perfect, best GL artist ever, Ethan Van Sciver. This book is now pretty much everything that I had hoped a new run on Green Lantern would be. Guy Gardner steals the show. He gets the best lines in the book. There's also like this. There's a lot of exposition that happens in there as well, in a conversation between Saronic Natu and Hal Jordan. But it's really great for some people who maybe didn't read all of the Sinestro solo series. It fills in some blanks there as to what happened in the time that Hal's been away and that, you know, the Green Lantern Corps has been missing. Like, how did the Sinestro Corps suddenly become the police force in the universe? And Saronic fills in the details. But this issue also sets up a major fight that's coming between the newly returned Green Lantern Corps and the seemingly at full and even fuller strength Sinestro Corps. Great dialogue. Beautiful art. This is the Green Lantern book that I am enjoying the most right now. No, and no disrespect to Green Lanterns, because I absolutely love that book as well, but Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, that is my book when it comes to the Green Lanterns. And another reason that this book deserves so much praise is because it's such a marked turnaround from where Robert Venditti was back prior to Rebirth. There's still a little twinge of a concept that I don't like from that still bleeding over into this, but I can forgive it because the art is gorgeous and because it seems like they're trying to resolve that. It's like they're trying to get to a natural place where they can do away with it. They know they couldn't just sweep it under the rug, so something's got to be done. And it feels like we're getting to that with in the backdrop of what feels like classic Green Lantern. And by classic, I mean it feels like Geoff Johns era Green Lantern again. And there ain't nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
So with that, those are my two absolute top picks. And I got a couple other books that I'll mention as definite standouts for the week that just missed the list. But before we do that, let's get to the dreaded part, the part that nobody likes to hear, but we got to say it, because there are at least two books out there that we read that didn't work for us. So, Kelly, what were your two that just didn't do it? Starting with, I know we've got one in common, so what's the one that we don't?
The one, Raven number one, which is a miniseries from DC Comics. It's the Raven character from Teen Titans. I saw it on the shelf. It was an impulse buy. And because, I love all of the Titans characters, and Raven's including in that. And I thought, well, this is cool. It's a little solo miniseries. Maybe this, we'll see how this is. And it just wasn't at all. It just didn't hit me on any level.
That was written by Marv Wolfman, too, wasn't it?
Yeah. I really don't know how to describe my feelings on the book, other than it just didn't hit anything for me. I read it and I was like, oh, okay.
It got the Kelly mark of shame.
Yeah, I the was, there wasn't, there just wasn't anything there for me. And I, wasn't really a fan of the art either. The art style was wasn't really digging that. So when you have kind of two factors like that, art and writing, I won't be picking up the rest of the series. That was enough for me to go, okay, well, because it was an impulse buy. It wasn't something I normally have on my list. And when you do an impulse buy and it's like, oh, this wasn't good. I'm not going to pick up any more of that. it just wasn't that great of a book to me. Now, of course, there are probably people listening that may love it, may think it's a great book. And to them, I'm like, awesome. I'm happy that you love it. It just didn't do it for me. And I wish it did, because I would have loved to have, read a new story with Raven, because it seems to me like they've de-aged her a bit again. So, which happens. When Marv Wolfman and George Perez relaunched the Titans back in the 80s, Raven to me was not so much a teenager. She was almost kind of like an adult to an extent, the way, her and Vic always seemed to be kind of, more adult-ish as far as characters go. But, of course, like everything, these characters get de-aged and reimagined. And it's the way comics work.
It is. And it's unfortunate to hear that, that series didn't work, because it was actually one I had been somewhat curious about, since, it's an in-continuity thing that's supposed to be laying a little more groundwork for her character in the new Teen Titans book that's out. And shouts to that book. It was actually pretty good. The Teen Titans Rebirth issue, I thought, was pretty engaging.
Yeah, I have to read that. I haven't read that yet.
I think you'll enjoy that more. It sounds like it's certainly more what you're looking for when it comes to the Teen Titans. But on to your final bottom book, which is one that you and I both put in the bottom list.
It unfortunately is another member of the Teen Titans, and it's Cyborg number one. This kind of goes to that goes back to the kind of Green Lanterns. Issue that didn't do it for me, where I kind of felt like I was rereading an older, like a rehashed story to an extent, or a rehashed idea that just they didn't do anything new with it. It's the same thing with Cyborg to an extent. They kind of retell his origin, they kind of give snippets of it. The dialogue or the writing just is bad to me. It was stale, dry, dull. Didn't really feel like there was any feeling in the words at all.
Yeah, I
and the art wasn't all of that. Again, in Live with Raven, the art wasn't that great either. And it's sad because, you know, the previous Cyborg series was pretty good. I mean, I enjoyed it to an extent. I didn't follow it, you know, completely, but I would, you know, I'd pick up an issue here or there, and mainly for money reasons, I didn't have it as a permanent issue on my pull list. But I mean, the Cyborg character is such a good character, and they've done so many really good things with him. I just would have loved for his series to be solid.
Yeah, and this wasn't. It wasn't for me either. I was lucky enough to be able to read the issue before I would have wound up spending money on it. And it was just the most boring slog that I've ever gone through. In all of Rebirth, it was just the most boring book that they've published in the entire line. The story felt like, I mean, there's something to be said for doing a throwback style story.
Yeah.
And this definitely was, but it was all the wrong parts of a throwback. It's heavily expository. It just didn't have anything that felt like it was giving it forward momentum. It even rehashed a lot of the same stuff that it did, or that this same writer had already done in Cyborg Rebirth, the one shot that came out last month. And it was like, if you were just going to do all this same stuff again, why did you bother?
Yeah.
And on top of that, I like Paul Pelletier as an artist. He's actually one of my favorites at DC, but this was uncharacteristically bad on his part. It felt very cluttered. The story had no real room to breathe. And just a bad book overall. There was nothing. I felt like I got nothing out of it.
The only thing that I found interesting was the last panel, where on all of the computer screens behind whoever that was, I can't remember.
A character called Malware.
Yeah. You had a lot of the established kind of DC cybernetic or robotic characters. So it seemed like to me that this book is going to be focusing on these other, you know, having these other robotic or cybernetic characters in DC kind of coming through this book.
Which is a fantastic idea.
Right. It's a great way to kind of reestablish these characters, maybe even, you know, debut, you know, people that have never seen them before. But, man, they just really got a lot of work to pull this book up for me to pick up another issue. You know, I was hoping that, you know, this would be good and I could say, hey, you know what, I'm just going to add this to my pull list. But I can't justify it.
Yeah, you know? You're a more generous man than I if you go back into that realm for another go, because I was so turned off that I'm out. I just can't buy that book. It was the same effect that Batgirl number one had on me. When I got to the end of it, I was like, that was such a rough, long slog that I have no desire to ever jump back in again. I'll come back whenever you change the creative team, maybe. But I got no desire to keep going. And it's incredibly disappointing, because Cyborg was one of those books that I was pretty excited about when the whole relaunch thing happened. And to have it turn out like this... I mean, if it weren't for the fact that Rebirth has overall been so great, I'd be really, really upset over this book. But one book that I'm actually a little bit more upset over, mainly because I keep being dumb and spending money on it, is Justice League. And Justice League number 5 closed out this first story arc, I guess is what we're going to call it, and... all I can say is I got to the end of it and my reaction was, eh.
Mm-hmm.
Eh. That was the whole thing. Actually, your voice popped in my head, Kelly, and I think you have a word for this.
Hmm.
Yep. That was it. That was the whole reaction for Justice League number 5 wraps up the story, I guess. No, there's nothing here that's going to make you care about any one of these characters. And that's the problem. Like, yes, they're established in other books, and it's, you know, we all care about them over there in those books. But over here, I still can't tell them apart in their voices. They all sound exactly the same. Everybody is written almost identical to one another. And the ending of this is not in any way intriguing. You get to the end of it and you're like, well, I'm kind of glad that's over. And I'm just blown away because I expected so much more from Brian Hitch. After such a, you know, even though it's been delayed horribly, Justice League of America has been very good. Every issue of it has been outstanding. And then whenever they said Brian Hitch and Tony Daniel were going to be together, I was like, hey, there's a guy who's already given me a really good Justice League story and one of my absolute favorite artists. How could this possibly go wrong? Well, folks, it went wrong. It didn't go off the rails, per se. It just feels like it never really got started.
Yeah.
It's one of those where it's like they punched the gas and the engine fell out of the bottom of the car. There's nothing to this anymore. So, with that said, I'm going to continue being dumb, I guess, because I'm going to keep buying Justice League, even though the preview for issue 6 gives me no hope that it's going to get any better. And the reason I'm doing it is because of the crossover that's coming up with Suicide Squad. Because that actually does intrigue me. Because Suicide Squad is, by all accounts, a pretty entertaining book. One that I'm really enjoying most of the aspects of. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's far better than what's happening over in Justice League.
Which is, it's disappointing because it's not, you know, Justice League is the premier kind of team book, and it's not good. It's not doing it.
It feels like it's not only not getting better, it feels like it's getting worse. And that's the most frustrating aspect of it. It's like, okay, I could understand if you were having trouble at the beginning, but once you get going, you should, you know, get your feet up under you. At least Flash has done that. Flash has like been on a steady incline for a couple of issues. Its most recent one being really good, but man, Justice League is just not winning, and I'm so frustrated because, you know, yes, it's hard to follow Geoff Johns, but this would be at the same level of meh even if they weren't following Geoff Johns.
Right.
So that's I got nothing really to say for this run of Justice League. I don't know what it's going to take to get it better, but I'm really starting to think that maybe a shift in creative team would help.
That sometimes helps, but it you know.
I mean, I hate to call it that early, too, because it's only 5 issues in. Well, 6 if you count the one-shot. But already I'm like, man, I really need a new creative team on this book. I need somebody to come in and do this better, because they are not good at it. Luckily, there is another book out there that features at least the big 3, Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, that came out this past week that nailed it for me, or the past week or 2 weeks ago, sometime within the last 2 weeks, this book came out. It's called Trinity from Francis Manapul. Mm-hmm. That book was the most fun I've had reading an elongated dinner party scene, because that's what it was. Yeah. And you know what?
Yeah.
I was entertained. I love the storytelling and the dialogue, these characters getting to know each other, and Francis Manapul's art was just gorgeous. Not to mention that he's got a really good handle on the voices of each of these individual characters. And I love how it seems to tie into what's happening over in Superman as well. Like, this feels like it's a Superman family book, or at least it takes place in the Superman line more so than like a Wonder Woman or a Batman book.
Yeah.
So I'm absolutely loving that.
I agree. I agree. I read it too and felt, you know, kind of almost in the same feelings you have about it. Now, is this going to be a miniseries, or is this an ongoing series?
It's an ongoing as far as I know. As far as being advertised, but it's a monthly book instead of a twice monthly.
Well, I mean, that's fine. I mean, I could go with just some monthly books.
Same here. Those twice monthly books are starting to add up. You fooled us, DC. You dropped your prices to $2.99, but then you were like, oh, but you have to buy them twice. clever girl.
I mean, Marvel did that a few years back too. So I mean,
yeah, they did, but they didn't go to $2.99. They kept it at $3.
Yeah. They were like, oh, we're gonna get you twice, but we're gonna keep the price the same. So
so you're buying Amazing Spider-Man, are you? Huh? You want to buy it twice a month? Sure, you do, kid. But guess what? You got to pay that price twice. But. Moving on from DC, that's right. I got a book to talk about that's not DC. Another book I picked up on a whim in the last 2 weeks was a new book from Rick Remender and Jerome Opeña. I guess is how you would pronounce his last name. Forgive me if I butchered it. But it's called Seven to Eternity. And I think this might be the most gorgeous book that's coming out right now. The artwork on this is just phenomenal. And it is a fantasy series, which is something that kind of surprised me a little bit, because I thought it might have been a combination of fantasy and tech, like fantasy sci-fi. And it does take place on another world, but it's very magical. It's like it is a fantasy style book. It fits in with that, but it's also got a bit of a Western feel, almost an Unforgiven like vibe going on. So, yeah, color me intrigued. I'm in.
Sounds interesting.
It's going to be one of those that may actually read better in trade, so I wouldn't blame anybody if they were like, I'll wait till that comes out in trade, but don't forget about it in that time. Like, because that's easy to do. Like, you'll say, I'm going to trade wait a book, and then you completely forget about it. Well, I'm telling you, do not forget about Seven to Eternity. This is a book that you're going to want to check out. I mean, just for the hell of it, go see if you can find issue one and give that a shot and say, all right, well, if I'm not buying the rest of it, I'm trade waiting it. At least you'll have an idea of why this book is so good. And Rick Remender, he usually delivers pretty well. He and Jerome are back together because they did Uncanny X-Force back in the day. And I think they had some other Marvel work that was also really popular. So this team is known in comics as being one that puts out good stuff, and I think they're going to win this one again. So, with that, I think that brings us to the end of the stuff that we read in the last couple of weeks. So, let's move on to some interesting news items, because there have been a few things that have come out. And Kelly, we got to start with kind of the big one from today, which today, folks, we're recording this on October 4th. So this has just been announced today. It's going to probably be a little old by the time you hear this, but DC Comics is reviving the Wildstorm imprint, and they put Warren Ellis in charge of it. Kelly, what was your reaction to that news?
I was pretty excited to hear that the Wildstorm, you know, universe, was coming back, and that Warren Ellis was going to be working on it. I mean, it's good.
Yes,
it sounds very good.
I would say that this is some of the best news that we've gotten in a little while. Much like how Gerard Way's Young Animal imprint works. Wildstorm is going to work the same way. And what I mean is, Young Animal is actually in continuity with DC Rebirth. You see the books with the DC Rebirth banner or Young Animal, they do take place in the same universe. They take place on the same Earth. It's just Young Animal is a mature reader's imprint that takes place in continuity, kind of like how Vertigo used to be. Remember, like, back in the day, that Sandman, like, in its first volume, actually featured Batman and Scarecrow? Mm-hmm. These Young Animal books can do the same thing. They can show those characters, they can, like, mention them, but by and large, they're going to completely be off in their own little corner, their own sandbox. They just happen to be in continuity and could be mentioned by other DC books if they needed to be, or if, you know, somebody found a creative way to do it. Well, Wildstorm is going to be very much like that. It's in canon, it's in continuity with DC Rebirth, but it plays in its own sandbox. So it won't be burdened so much by what's happening over in DC Rebirth. That way, everybody can kind of have their cake and eat it too. Now, Warren Ellis is going to be writing one book that we know of. He's writing a book called The Wild Storm, and that's going to be serving as like a launching pad for future series. And the ones that we know of so far that are coming out are going to be Michael Cray, Wildcats, and Zealot. But of course, no creative teams have been announced for this yet. But with New York Comic Con coming up this weekend, I wouldn't be surprised if we found out at least a couple of creative teams by then, or maybe even a few more books that might be coming out. So, Kelly, I know you're probably going to be adding a couple of these books to your list. I know I will be.
Yeah, I've always been a fan of the, you know, Wildstorm characters. I'm really happy to hear that it's not going, they're not going to be connected to, it's going to be their own set place, which I think that's where they work best. I really didn't like the idea of them being part of the New 52 universe when the New 52 was being launched.
Well, I felt like hindered by it in a way because they couldn't really do the same kind of stories that they had been doing.
No, I mean, you couldn't really go and do the Daemonite Cherubim kind of story arcs that were pretty much the basics for a lot of the early Wildcats. You know, what was kind of an ongoing kind of story arc for the Wildcat comic back when it was being published. And it just felt like, you know, giving Voodoo her own book and even Grifter at a point trying to establish them and Stormwatch. And I just, it was so, just didn't feel right. And even, you know, Teen Titans, which was one of the worst New 52 titles because, I mean, they had Fairchild from Gen 13 involved in it. And they were, it was just a mess. And that's why, I mean, this, you know, Warren Ellis being in charge and him, you know, them being separate, I think they could just do more storytelling, you know, drawing from the Wildcat universe and not having to deal with any of the DC baggage.
Yeah, I mean, they can still interact with DC characters. They just
sure. I mean, it could be it could be one of the multiverses or one of the. I mean, they.
Well, it is on the same Earth. So far as we know, like the Young Animal is on the same Earth. Like it's all there. Oh. But what they should do now that they've experimented with this, if this takes off, which I think with Warren Ellis in charge of it, it could. Somebody needs to do something with Milestone already. Because
yeah,
we're sitting here waiting.
Yeah,
like you've got you know, Icon and Rocket. What about Static Shock? We're sitting over here waiting on these characters to show up. And well, where they at, DC? You've been talking about doing something with Milestone for the last couple of years, and we've barely seen anything happening with that. But But at least, you know, finally something is happening with the house that Jim Lee built, and I'm pretty excited about it. It would make me even more excited if Jim Lee were to be drawing one of these books, but at the same time, I also like the idea of a book coming out on time, so I'm torn here. I would like it to happen, but not be hampered by the fact that they can't seem to get the book done.
Right.
But in any case, that's some big cool news that I'm pretty excited about. Some other news that, Kelly, you're probably going to be really excited about this one. Jack Kirby's 100th birthday celebration with the DC Commandy Challenge.
Yeah.
A 12-issue miniseries featuring a who's who of big creative teams. Did you take a look at these? And if you did, which... if any of them kind of stuck out to you, like, I got to read that.
I actually did. I just saw the snippet about the DC Challenge Commandy and what it was about, but I didn't get a chance to look into it further about the creative teams. But, I mean, just the fact that they're doing it is really enough to keep my interest and bring me up. Like, I'll definitely check this out. I mean... I'm a fan of Kirby's creations, and so, you know.
Yep, and supposedly this will be an in-continuity story that may be actually tying over to the Batman Beyond book that also just launched this past week, and I recommend that you go read it. It's actually very good. But there are a couple of names that stuck out to me, at least, as far as this Commandy book is coming up. One would definitely be Bill Willingham is going to be paired up with Ivan Reis. So that's going to be a big one for me, I think. And Keith Giffen and Steve Rude are doing issue 8. But probably the most interesting one, at least as far as I am concerned, is issue 9 is going to be done by Tom King and Kevin Eastman, the co-creator of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, making his DC debut. So this is that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there's also like Neil Adams is involved with this. So is Peter Tomasi, Jimmy Palmiotti, and Amanda Connor. Steve Orlando, Philip Tan, Greg Pak, and Joe Prado. Walt Simonson is coming in for this. So is Gail Simone and Ryan Sook. And even Marv Wolfman. Jose Luis Garcia Lopez is also in on this. Dan Abnett, Dale Eaglesham, and even Dan DiDio is putting his mark on this in a small way. So huge names coming out the woodwork for all of this. So I'm not a big Commandy fan, I guess, but at the same time, with all of these creators getting together to make something interesting here, I think I got to check this out. I think this is something that is going to be worth looking into, whether you're a longtime fan or if you're new to it. I mean, it's with those creative teams on this, there is no way that you shouldn't be reading it. Kelly, you're a Commandy fan, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I read, you know, some of those issues, you know, way back when. Interesting character, but like, you know, I'm a fan, like I said, of Kirby's creations. You know, from OMAC to, of course, I mean, the New Gods, and you know, just Kirby just had a. He just had a way with creating things and characters, and you know, he got into this thing. I mean, he created the New Gods for DC, and in the early to mid 70s, he created a comic called The Eternals, which was kind of like the New Gods, you know, with a Marvel spin on it. And of course, the Eternals is I'm a fan of that because it's just a Kirby creation, and I'm just a fan of you know who he was and what he brought to the you know the comic book genre. I mean, he's
genre.
You know, he's well, you know, the comic book world in that sense. I mean, he's the king. I mean, that's why they call him King Kirby. I mean, he had a lot to do with a lot of the creations that are the cornerstones of Marvel. You know, when you think about it, and like I said, you know, just I'm a fan. I'm happy to see this happen.
I'm hoping that the character can finally like get some traction because he hasn't really gotten a lot the last couple of times that they've tried to do something with him. But maybe the secret is putting on a top tier creative team on there, or in this case, 12 top tier creative teams doing one issue each. So we will see how that works out. But there's a couple of other big things happening with DC that we're going to be hearing more about at New York Comic Con, probably on Thursday. As we know, Steve Orlando was announced recently as the writer of a new Justice League of America series that's going to be spinning out of Justice League versus Suicide Squad. And that series is going to launch in February. And it was just announced that one of the artists joining him on the twice-monthly title is going to be Ivan Reis. So that, ladies and gentlemen, is huge. Ivan Reis is a guy who has done a lot of amazing work with Geoff Johns on Justice League and on Green Lantern. So this is huge. This is a big get on that book. But we've also been learning a little bit about the lineup. And in January, there are going to be 4 one-shot issues coming out featuring the 4 key members or the 4 main members of the JLA. Of course, that's not all of them, but it is the main ones. Now, one is going to be, the first one is going to be Vixen. And all of these are written by Steve Orlando with various artists joining him on the one-shots. Another is going to be The Atom, which is going to be Ryan Choi, actually. Because, as it turns out, Ray Palmer is missing. If you read the DC Universe Rebirth one-shot, you know that he's in the micro-universe, or the microverse. And this is going to be a kind of an intro to Ryan Choi, the second Atom. Or a third Atom, I guess. I don't know. It's hard to keep up with how many people have been called the Atom, Kelly.
Yeah.
But there are 2 that really stuck out to me as being like kind of off the wall picks, but no less like absolutely interesting and like attention getting. That would be the Ray and Killer Frost.
Mm-hmm.
So, Kelly, I know you might have, looking at this roster so far, what's jumping out at you?
Well, definitely the Justice League, you know, Justice League of America, that's bringing the Ray in is one of those characters that I'm like, okay, cool. I can deal with that. That's the Ray's from is a member of another somewhat famous team called the Freedom Fighters, which several years ago had their own little, you know, this was before New 52. But I mean, this was a team that's been around for some time. It was on one of the multiverses. I want to say it was like Earth X or something, where, you know, the Nazis won the war and you know, he had like Uncle Sam and the Ray and the Human Bomb and Phantom Lady and Doll Man and Black Condor. And I mean, just this team of this eclectic team of people kind of battling Nazis and stuff on their Earth. Yeah, I mean, and the Ray's had, you know, a few solo series. I want to say like in the 90s or maybe the 80s, he had his own ongoing series for a while. Mm-hmm. And you know, the other Killer Frost, I mean, that's another good character to be playing around with since, you know, we've seen her on the small screen already.
Yep, she's been featured heavily on Flash, or at least her alter ego has, Caitlin Snow. So it could be that, you know, we're seeing a redemption arc for Killer Frost. Like mm-hmm. her trying to come in from the cold, if you will, and not be you know, a stone cold killer. Okay, I'll stop now. I probably won't. But the thing is that she's like Clayface over in Detective Comics. It's one of those characters where people are probably like, wait, can this person really be a hero given all the terrible things that they've done? And Clayface has been done pretty freaking well over in Detective Comics. So I'm thinking, yeah, okay, if they want to take Killer Frost and try to flip that character and make her a little more heroic, give it a shot. Let's see how that turns out. Another thing about the Ray is the version they're going with is Ray Terrell, who is actually a legacy character. He was not the first Ray. And he's also probably going to be the first LGBT character to be featured in the Justice League. So that's pretty, you know, solid, diverse lineup so far. Of course, we don't know everybody who's on the team yet, but maybe we'll be finding out this coming up weekend. But I am far more excited about Justice League of America than I am about what's happening over in the main Justice League book right now.
Yeah, I agree.
I think this is the more interesting book. I think that it has far more storytelling potential. And that's mostly because of a really interesting lineup so far and a creative team that is just out of this world. So, yeah, I'm totally buying that book. And I think I'm going to have a lot more fun with it. But speaking of fun, we got only two more books to mention before we get ready to move on to something else. Kelly, they went and did it. They blew it up. The bastards, animals. They're actually going to cross over Green Lantern and Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, I saw that.
This is happening. What are we going to do, man? I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to go buy it. We're totally going to buy it. And it's because Boom Studios and DC have done amazing work so far with their crossovers. They seem to mesh really well together. Those Green Lantern Star Trek issues were fantastic. Batman Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, that was another one that was just the most fun comic I read and part of last year, the late part of last year and early this year. So that they're going to cross over Green Lantern and Planet of the Apes. You know what? Why not? Why not? I don't really have any clue where this is going to go, but Kelly, what did you think about that announcement?
The crossovers they've done with, you know, Green Lantern and I don't know. They tend to do a good job with it. It's so yeah. I mean, I'll give at least the first issue a shot. I mean, I'm a fan of the Planet of the Apes films from, you know, back in the day. So I mean, it you know.
If they use Guy Gardner, I think it would be a travesty if at some point he doesn't say, "Get your damn dirty, get your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape." That's just got to happen. And with that, we still have no idea about who the creative team is on this book. It was just an announcement that was made this past week. It's coming out in February of 2017. So be on the lookout for that. You're probably going to hear some more about it in the coming weeks. But it just sounded like fun. And speaking of other books that sounded like fun, off in a different universe altogether, away from DC completely, James Robinson is going to be giving us a Felix Leiter book. It's a little James Bond spinoff miniseries about basically James Bond, James Bond's CIA counterpart. He's a character that definitely has a little bit of a fan base, I would say. And the James Bond series that have been launching lately have all been pretty good. Be they from, I believe it was Warren Ellis who was writing one arc. It was very good, or two arcs that were really good. And then you got Andy Diggle writing another, also a good book. So the James Bond books right now are on a pretty solid roll. So I think that having a Felix Leiter miniseries could be intriguing. Could be something that James Bond fans definitely want to get in on. Mm-hmm. And of course, one last thing before we move on. The Marvel moment of our little rundown, our little, yeah, our version of the rundown or whatever, is the Death of X number one preview. Now, Kelly, we talked about this a little earlier.
Yeah.
Look at that lineup and tell me your thoughts.
Didn't we, like, have a Facebook chat about this?
I think we did.
I gotta say that I'm interested in picking up. You know, I'll probably pick up the first issue just to read it, just to see what's going on. But, you know, the lineup they have for this book is total shit. Garbage. Just, I mean, okay. Cyclops, Emma Frost. Okay, I can see that, though. I'm really sick of seeing, you know, that hideous costume Scott's in with the red X across his face.
Maybe that's what Death of X actually means. We're not killing off mutants. We're just wiping that stupid thing off his face.
Pretentious douche. Then Emma Frost, everyone's favorite bitch. Magic. Okay, you know, I like Magic as a character. I do. But I've just never really digged the fact that she was part of a group. I always loved her as a solo character. Iceman, okay, you got another core member of the original team. And by the way, I mean, he's an Omega level mutant. That's not a bad person to have on this side. The Stepford Cuckoos, I've never liked. Let me say this again. Never. And lastly, Gold Balls, which, you know, just the name alone, it's like...
I'm sorry, but that's a legit character name.
That's a legit character name. He fires gold balls out of any part of his body. Okay.
It doesn't get any better than that.
I mean, this is just an insult to the book.
I was really hoping that his origin would involve a horrible smelting accident. but that was too much to hope for, wasn't it?
Yeah, and then on the Inhumans, again, you have Crystal and Gorgon, which are part of the royal family. I get that. I understand why they're there. I'm glad they're there. Then you've got three or four other new Inhumans that I have no clue who they are. And don't give a shit about any of them. You know, it to me, they're all four of them are throwaway characters. They're, you know, after this, who knows if we'll see them again. 9 times out of 10, any new characters that Marvel come out with, that they put in a book like this, in this kind of ensemble, none of them, I mean, only a handful of them will come to the surface and make an impact where they'll be something. Other than just a cardboard stand-up for background, you know, whatever. You know, back.
Odds on gold balls actually surviving this event.
And you know the artwork? I'm looking at it. I'm not digging the artwork that much either.
That was the one part I was actually kind of sold on.
Well, I mean,
it's not Aaron Cooter's best work.
It's not shitty. I mean, it's not complete garbage, but I just figured for a book of this caliber and they're doing something, you'd get somebody, I don't know, somebody that's done the X-Men. I don't know. Has this guy done X-Men before? Or is this his?
Not that I'm aware of. He had a great run on Action Comics with Greg Pak. But as far as I know, I don't know what his history really is with Marvel. I know he has to have worked with them before, I think. But X-Men, I'd have to go back and look to see. But at the same time, my biggest problem here is that you're doing a death of X, which is all supposed to be leading up to X-Men versus Inhumans. And we're not really busting out the A-list here, are we? This is this seems like the D reserves. And I am just not feeling the character usage here. I don't see how this is really going to excite people to read it. Maybe when Inhumans versus X-Men starts up, that will be a little more fun, a little more intriguing. But this as a lead up, just not doing it for me. At least Unworthy Thor had a preview come out, another preview come out this week, and it still looks absolutely gorgeous. That book is going to be one that everybody needs to go and check out whenever it happens, and to keep reading the other Thor title, because it's still fun. Like the issue that came out just a couple of weeks ago was actually very good. And moved the story forward in a very positive way. Took a player off the board that I was definitely ready to see gone, and set up yet another really good story, or at least a good story point to follow into. So there are good books at Marvel. They're just apparently not going to come from Inhumans or from the main X-Men line right now. So well, there you are.
I don't want to sound like I'm completely poo-pooing on this series. I think where my frustration and my animosity and maybe my irritation comes from the fact that we're even having this book, and that I'm really sick of the Inhumans. I'm sick of the Inhumans agenda Marvel has been throwing at us. Mainly, I think, a lot of reasons because they don't have the rights to the X characters anymore. So, I mean, we're seeing, well, we have the Inhumans. Let's try to put them in the place where mutants were, and we can do movies about them. We could do television shit, and it just, I don't know. Yeah, I could be wrong, but it seems that way.
And by rights, we mean that they don't have the film rights to put them in like the MCU, but they can do Inhumans, and it's very clear that the Inhumans are being used as a stand-in for mutants in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and to not very good effect. People aren't really digging it. I mean, I think that's evidenced by the pullback from Inhumans that we're seeing on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. this season, and the shift towards more magical realms with Ghost Rider, and what could very well be a tie to Doctor Strange, since that is the movie they're trying to promote. I did finally watch the second episode of this season's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Not bad per se, but also not to the point where I'm like, yay, I'm very excited to keep watching the show. It's gone from being the unwatchable train wreck mess that season 3 was to being, this is a show that exists. It doesn't offend me. It doesn't incite. Yeah. It doesn't excite me. It just nothings me. So I think one more episode to see if it's going to pick up, and if it doesn't, I don't I'm not going to feel bad dropping it. I will move on. And this week, as you all know, is the return of the CW onslaught of Flash, Arrow, Legends of Tomorrow, and then Monday next week we'll be getting Supergirl. So all the big DC shows are back in play. But if you guys want to hear more about that, you want to hear about all the cool stuff that's happening on the CW shows and some of my thoughts on it, you can go check out the latest episode of Geek and Sassy with Jennifer and Miranda, because I kind of made a surprise run-in because I had to remind them that hashtag Gotham sucks. And I did. Repeatedly. Much to Miranda's chagrin. And you can hear her get very upset with me all on this episode. And it was so much fun to record. I actually had a really great time with those two ladies. So make sure you guys go check out Geek and Sassy. And if you want more movie and TV show breakdown news, stuff with some like hard-hitting, deeper analysis, also invite you to go listen to the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Greg and Nick. They get into what you're reading, what you're watching every single week. It is my absolute favorite segment of their show. So make sure you go check that out. And with that, we've kind of come to the end of our first half of this wonderful program. And we're going to take a break, but when we come back, it's all Batman all the time. We are going to get deep into it on The Dark Knight. We're going to tell you about everything we love about Batman, and we're going to be providing you a little guide, too. If you're a new fan, you're definitely going to want to stick around. If you've been reading Batman a little while, come on back. And hell, even if you have been reading Batman for years, you'll still want to hear some of the things that we've got to talk about in this next half, because this is a guide to Batman for everyone. Not just the new reader, but people who have been maybe out of the game for a little while, or people who have been in it for years. So make sure you come on back, and we will see you in just a few minutes.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you're subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Just head to iTunes today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be podcast feed, the PWO PTBN feed, PTBN Pop, and of course the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcasts. Some really great stuff. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. Thanks for being a fan of professional wrestling. More importantly, thanks for being a fan and supporter of the Place to Be Nation.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here. In addition to the archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous vintage vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. All of this in addition to Scott Keith's Podcast of Doom, which includes discussions on questions from listeners as well as current day and old school wrestling. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows are available on PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out on the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network. where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the Reaction Shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
Gentlemen, let's broaden our minds. Lawrence!
Place to Be Nation, welcome back. We're here to talk all things Batman. Batman, can someone please tell me what kind of a world we live in when a man dressed up as a bat gets to be the most popular comic book character? This fandom needs an enema. And here to help me do just that is my number one guy, Kelly. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Welcome back, folks. That's enough of that. It's enough of my Jack Nicholson, which is admittedly not very good. But what is going to be good is our list. Not so much a list, I guess. We're just we're going to be talking a little shop here. We're going to be talking a little, like, everything Batman. And the way this is going to work is pretty simple. We want to help all the listeners out there to better enjoy Batman. So Kelly and I talked, and we came up with, like, a series of different books for different types of readers, as well as TV shows and movies that we feel are essential for being a Batman fan. So if you've never given the character a chance before, or if you've had a long, you know, story history with the Caped Crusader, this is going to be for you. This is for all the Batman fans out there. And I feel like the most logical place to start with any good guide to Batman would be at the beginning. So let's talk about all things Batman. Kelly, you feeling up for that?
Yeah.
Cool. Kelly, as some of you may know, used to own a comic shop called Empire Comics down in Enterprise, Alabama, and of course you encountered your fair share of Batman fans over the years, I'm sure.
Yeah, sure.
I happened to be one of those fans at one point, because that was one of the first books that I was buying on a regular basis from Kelly, was Batman. Shortly after the untimely death of Bruce Wayne in Final Crisis. But we're not going to get into all that insanity, because nobody wants to talk about that. We want to talk about how... First, we want to talk about how do you get started reading Batman. So this first part is going to be me and Kelly talking about the books that we would recommend to somebody if they walked into the comic shop, they're a new reader, or maybe they've been interested in Batman, they just never given it a shot, and they say, hey, I want to read Batman, what do you recommend? And Kelly, as a former shop owner, which one jumps out at you first? Like, which one is your absolute, this is the book you must absolutely read? What do you hand them first?
I think, like, when I go back and I think about my Batman reading experience, I think the first really pivotal story that got me to, you know, because I had read Batman books growing up, you know, here or there, you know, an issue here, issue there, maybe a one-shot. But as far as a complete kind of story arc, I never really followed one up until, I guess, the early 80s, mid-80s. Maybe it's I'm really not too familiar about when this book actually came out. It was the Nightfall miniseries, where Bane, you know, is the pivotal villain in that series, and of course Bruce gets injured, very badly, and
Bane straight up breaks his back.
Yeah. I mean, and so you're dealing with Bruce now, who is incapacitated to say the least. And another character who's been kind of bouncing around, can't remember his real name, but he went by Azrael. And
John Paul Valley.
Yeah. He ends up kind of saying, okay, well, you know what? I'll, you know, Bruce and him, I mean, he ends up basically becoming the heir apparent for the Bat Mantle and kind of takes over as Batman. Why Bruce is recovering, or they're trying to figure out, you know, what's he going to do. But he takes it really to the extreme. I mean, he's not like Bruce in the way that he deals with things, and he goes for a more... He doesn't just put on Bruce's costume. He goes for a more high-tech, version of I guess, the Bat costume. And even the Robin, the current Robin at the time, is like, man, we don't do stuff like this, you know, and basically telling him, hey, you know, you're not being Batman. You're not doing Batman right. You know, and eventually he kicks him out of the Batcave. And, you know, it's really a really good story. I mean, it's like, what happens when Bruce gets put out of commission, and we've got somebody else coming in to look after the city. This person, you know, is he going to follow in Bruce's footsteps, or is he going to be a little more physical? And, you know, it's a good story. I don't want to, you know, get too much into it. I think I've, you know, kind of gone over a lot of things that basically sum up the series in and of itself, but it basically is a tale of, okay, we have somebody who is now the Batman, and he's obviously doing things that the original Batman wouldn't do. And when your villains start going, I don't know who that is in the Bat costume, but that can't be the same guy. You know, you're definitely making an impression, and not a good one.
Yeah, it really does touch on a lot of the tenets of what makes Batman who he is. And it goes to a really dark place. But, I mean, DC was kind of in a dark place at the time that story came out, because they had also just done the death of Superman. So it was kind of a time when other people were stepping in to replace the main, like, big heroes. But I think Nightfall also illustrates exactly why Bruce Wayne will always be the King Daddy, why he will always be the Batman. And that's, I think that's important whenever you're establishing, like, a new fan, like whenever you want them to read something like that. And it establishes Bane, who is a tremendous villain, who also, unfortunately, gets done a little dirty in that series. They built him up as this, like, really great threat, and then they put him down way too fast.
That kind of happens sometimes in stories like this. You bring in this. I mean, Doomsday was kind of done the same way. Doomsday was created to kill Batman, Superman in an extent. But it wasn't until after the fact that they actually started going in and doing. You know, we weren't given all this background information prior to his appearance and all this. It was just kind of a mystery, but it would have been nice to see that setup that he just wasn't this this creation. He said, let's create this character that'll kill Batman. How about giving some substance to him? You know?
Yeah. That would have been good for Doomsday. I think, they did give him a pretty good origin later.
Later, but I was like, you know,
but at the time, yeah, he's just this hulking force that, comes in and beats Superman to death.
And takes Guy Gardner and slams his head in a car door several times.
And punches the Matrix version of Supergirl so hard that her face liquefies, which is still one of the funniest scenes I've ever read. But that's neither here nor there. Sorry, we're getting off on a Superman tangent. But as far as Nightfall goes, like, I can absolutely see that as a story that you could hand to somebody and say, here, read this. It will help establish your fandom. I take a slightly different approach, because I want to go for one of the classics and go Batman Year One, because that's just the beginning. That, in a lot of people's minds, that is the definitive Batman story. Or at least the definitive beginning, and it definitely influenced like movies like Batman Begins. There's been an animated movie made out of it. It's not quite verbatim the comic, but it's very close. It's a Frank Miller classic. You know, he really taps into the darker, grittier side of the character, but at his beginnings. So you see the young man who's driven, who's like very obsessive over what he does, but he's also very calculating. And I think it gives you more than just the death of the Waynes as a motivation for Bruce. You start to see like the deeper psychology of the character. But you also get introduced in a really cool way to James Gordon, who is new to Gotham City. So in a lot of ways, the story of Gordon and the story of Bruce parallel each other in that story. And it's a great way of being introduced to not just Batman, but some of his supporting cast, too. It's also an origin for Selina Kyle, way before she actually dons the Catwoman costume. That would be where I would tell somebody to start. And the great thing is about both Nightfall and Year One, pretty much all the books I think we're going to talk about, is they're easy to find for the most part. Mm-hmm. At your local comic shop, at bookstores, or through any online digital retailers. I'm sure that you will be able to find these books. Of course, the absolute best way is to go to your local comic shop and talk to somebody about it. Which is kind of what we're doing right here, but that would be, I think that's a definitive beginning, at least in my eyes, is Batman Year One. It's heavily influential. Like, there are people who still reference that book whenever they say, like, a new Batman writer comes on. Like Scott Snyder, for instance, references Batman Year One quite a bit. as a heavy influence on his own Batman writing. So that's why it sticks out to me.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's such a... And this was the first of the Earth One series of books that
I mean, Year One.
Year.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned Earth One quite yet.
Earth One. I mean, that's what I meant to say, Earth One. It was the first of the Earth One series, wasn't it, that started?
No, this is Frank Miller's Year One.
Oh, Year One. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But moving on from that, Kelly, you had another book that jumped out at you that you said would be good to put in people's hands, and it's actually what I would call my favorite Batman story of all time.
Yeah, it's one of mine too. Not the favorite, but it's I mean my favorite's on the list, but are you know, but it's definitely up there. It's a good story called Hush.
Yes.
And initially,
yes.
Initially, what got me drawn to the book, because again, like I said, I read Batman kind of sporadic. When there's a new story arc that I hear coming down the pipe, I may, you know, pick it up. But I knew that Jim Lee was doing the art, and I was like, oh man, that's got to be good. I'll pick it up. I mean. But initially what drew me was the art, and then, of course, the story kept me riveted. And it's, you know, I don't really want to give too many details, but wouldn't you think, Russell, that this is kind of a story kind of in the arc of Bruce's past kind of coming back? In a sense,
it's a story that adds a new wrinkle to his past,
right?
That maybe had never been explored before. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what made it so intriguing, was it touches on a part of Bruce's life that we almost never see, which is the like part of those 8 to 10 years before his parents were killed. Because there was a time when Bruce Wayne was a pretty happy kid. He had a, you know, he was rich kid for sure, but he had a pretty happy home life and he had friends. And this story picks up one of those, you know, one of those little elements that had never really been explored before, and it brings it into a modern style of storytelling for Batman. Again, like you, I was drawn to it through Jim Lee's art. But it was Jeff Loeb's writing that kept me. I think that his voice for Batman is just about second to none. I don't know that there are many people who write him quite that well. And we'll talk a little bit more about Hush a little later on, and we'll definitely be mentioning Jeff Loeb again, because this is not his only appearance on the list. But we both agreed on one book absolutely being a perfect place to start for new readers, people who are new to Batman, and that was the Geoff Johns and Gary Frank Batman Earth One.
Yes.
That is one that was really unexpected, because Geoff Johns doesn't have a heavy history with Batman, but he really reinvents, not so much reinvents the wheel, but he takes Batman in a somewhat unique direction that also manages to feel a little familiar. Basically, it's signature Geoff Johns. If you've ever read any of his work, or if you've seen Gary Frank's absolutely gorgeous art, I mean, these two have worked together on Superman multiple times, but their take on Batman was really intriguing. What is it about Earth One that got to you?
The way Alfred was reimagined in this series. I mean, I've always loved the relation between Bruce and Alfred. I think that's probably one of the, out of all the relationships, and you have supporting characters, and every character, you know, Superman has his supporting cast, and Wonder Woman, and so forth. I think Bruce, Alfred is by far the number one supporting cast member in a comic series.
So we would absolutely say that Alfred is Bruce's number one a guy.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very much so. And this Alfred is a tough SOB. I mean, not that the yeah, normal is. Alfred isn't a tough SOB, but this guy, I mean, you run out of the gate. You know that this is not your mom and dad's Alfred. This is a guy who is like a security specialist. He was hired by, you know, Thomas Wayne to, you know, be head of security for himself and his family.
This is not the Alfred to fuck with.
Yeah, this guy, it's, you know, in a lot of ways, the Alfred that is in the Gotham series, and I know there's mixed feelings about Gotham.
Hashtag Gotham Alfred, sucks.
I didn't say that, Miranda. He did.
Hashtag Gotham sucks. I'm going to keep saying it, Miranda. I don't care how mad you get.
That Alfred kind of reminds me of him in a sense. I mean, he's not as, I mean, of course, gruff and real, you know, but he has that kind of, I mean, they've talked a lot about his military training, and, you know, that's been one of the things that he's used in a lot of ways to help train Bruce to be who he needs to be. But it's just a really interesting retelling of the Bat mythos and the origin of the Batman.
I think one of the things I appreciate about this version of it is it tries to be slightly more realistic with a guy dressing up in yes, he's a well-trained guy. He's a guy who spent a lot of his life, you know, getting ready to do this. But he finds out very quickly that no matter how much prep time you put into it, things are going to go horribly wrong.
Yeah.
And if you've ever read the book Kick-Ass, I would say that there's a little element of that in Batman Earth 1, especially his first time out in the suit. He doesn't exactly inspire fear so much as he inspires confusion and maybe some light laughter.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that he does not die on his first time out. And Alfred is so freaking hilarious in the book because he's constantly looking at Bruce saying, "You are an idiot. You are going out there without a gun. What kind of moron goes and faces down somebody who is armed to the teeth?
Yeah.
And you're going to go out there in a Halloween costume with your fisticuffs and you think you're going to win. You're a moron. And your parents are going to be so ashamed of me for letting you go out there dressed like this."
Yeah. He's a rough old bird. I mean, he's not. There's no coddling of Bruce. Not that I think, you know, Alfred, you know, really got into doing that a lot with Bruce. Maybe when he was younger, but as he got older, he became more sarcastic in his coddling to, you know, basically, you know.
I think the sarcasm was always there, but this Alfred isn't so much sarcastic as he is just a hard ass. Like he has no time for Bruce's shit.
It's like Nick Fury, you're just top notch military guy that just, yeah, you're dumb. Quit doing that. You're gonna get yourself killed.
Yeah, exactly. Like he's like, I have no time for your shit. This is,
yeah.
He's like, stop being an idiot and start doing this right. And the book has a couple of like shocking moments in it too. Like when Bruce finally starts to get into a rhythm and like learning how to actually be, you know, a vigilante and be like start to hone some of those detective skills. He takes on a pretty disturbing case as his first case in Gotham. And he's not the, like, those two aren't the only characters who get like a pretty drastic reimagining. Penguin gets one too. And as much as I hate the version of Penguin they use on Gotham, I absolutely love the version of Penguin they used in Batman Earth 1. I thought that was much more intriguing, much more like what I was hoping to see out of the TV series of Gotham. And I even enjoyed their huge twist on Harvey Bullock, which was a big swerve out of left field. We're used to seeing that fat, slovenly slob of a guy who yet is still a very good detective. This version of Harvey Bullock is basically a reality TV star. He's trying to be that guy. And just some crazy, outlandish ideas that are pulled off magnificently by Jeff Johns and Gary Frank. So, guys, if you're going to check out your first ever Batman book, I think Kelly and I agree that Batman Earth 1 is going to be the book for you. That's the one that we absolutely agree on. We would hand this to you and say, read this.
Yeah.
But this whole thing shouldn't be just about new fans. Like, we should be talking about fans that have been reading Batman for a while. Like, they're more familiar. Like, they know Batman's history. At least to a degree. Like, you've seen the movies. You know where he's coming from. You know about his extensive rogues gallery. But maybe you're looking for something a little different. You're looking for a Batman to face down a villain that he's never encountered before. And Kelly mentioned this book as a good first book, and while I do agree to an extent with that, I'm going to have to say that I think this is a book for people who know a little bit more about Batman, and that would be my all-time favorite Batman story, Hush. It's a Jeff Loeb, Jim Lee classic, and it features almost the entire lineup of Batman's rogues gallery making an appearance at some point in the story. But the real meat of the idea is that each of these characters are being manipulated from behind the scenes by someone who knows that Bruce and Batman are one and the same. And he's playing the field in that direction. And what I think I appreciate most about this series is its use of misdirection. Because that's something that Jeff Loeb and Jim Lee did a masterful job of. I mean, this was a clinic on how to set up a good mystery and to keep people guessing. Like, you never know where the story is going to go next. And it's one of those that I revisit probably about once every year or so. I go back and reread this story just because it is... Batman at his best. Like, this is the single best version of Batman that I think has ever been put to page. So I cannot recommend that story enough. But like I said before, Jeff Loeb is not making only a single appearance on this list for one book, because he's got others. And Kelly, I think we both enjoy a certain two-part series, or a two-graphic novel series, anyway, from Jeff Loeb. Why don't you tell people about it?
Yes, that's my my book was Batman: The Long Halloween, and it was, of course, done by Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale, and it's just a really, 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 you know, it's a long series, but it is good all the way through. This series ran from, I want to say, 96 all the way through 97. And, you know, it deals with a lot of, it deals with, like, the mob families. Which, you know, you don't always see that in a lot of the Batman stories now. It deals with a killer named Holiday who is out murdering people on holidays. And, you know, Bruce is trying to, you know, figure out, you know, be the detective and figure out who it is before another person gets whacked. And, you know, it's just, you know, it's one of those stories that I think is, you know, it's for me, I think, you know, someone who's read a lot of Batman stories and is pretty knowledgeable, this is really a good book to get into because, you know, it's 13 issues. Well, it's in a compendium now. It's probably in a trade. You might be able to gather those issues. I don't know if they're really that expensive. But
it might be hard to find though. So the trade is definitely the way to go.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're a collector though, I mean, I can understand wanting to track those down. But yeah, of course, if you're just for the story, it's in trade.
Continuously. Cause this is, that's a book that I don't see DC ever letting lapse because it, there's a reason it's a bestseller. It and its other part, Dark Victory. I don't think that you can really take one without the other.
No. I think both should be read to get. Well, you know, should be read as a whole. You know,
and what I think what I enjoyed most about Long Halloween Dark Victory was that they're continuations of Batman Year One. They take place in that same universe, so they reference events that took place in Batman Year One. Mm-hmm. You also see kind of like the Falcone and the Maroni families. Mm-hmm. So this is actually a two-part series that heavily influenced the Christopher Nolan Dark Knight trilogy. Especially the Dark Knight, because that story of Harvey Dent. His rise to power and his fall from grace, that was lifted very much from Long Halloween and Dark Victory. Joker's story is not really part of this because Joker he's in it, but he's not a huge part of the story. So this is more about like the rise and fall of Harvey Dent. And it's also a pretty good origin story for Dick Grayson, for fans of that character.
Yeah.
And like Hush, it's another one of those books that keeps you guessing. Like the mystery is laid out there, the clues are everywhere, and sometimes it's not even in the writing. It's like in little things in the art. And Tim Sale's art is not exactly my favorite, but
I love his stuff. I love his stuff.
Oh, sure. He has a signature style.
Mm-hmm.
If you see Tim Sale art one time, you'll probably be able to pick it out from then on.
Yeah.
Because he is often imitated, but he can never be duplicated.
Oh, no.
Seen many people try, but they have failed. But that brings us to another book that I think is a bit for more experienced readers, or at least people who are more familiar with Batman's history. But a classic just the same. And that would be Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo's The Court of Owls. The opening arc for Batman in the New 52 turned out to be one of the all-time greatest Batman stories ever put to page. Greg Capullo's art just fits the Batman character. I don't know another word to say it. It just fits Batman. Like, he had done all this work on Spawn and on another book called Haunt over at Image Comics. And then he comes over to DC, and yeah, the natural fit for him was Batman. His take on the character is second to none. Like, I would put it like right there with Jim Lee's. It's different, but it's very close. But this is another one of those stories it has a deep mystery at its heart, because I mean, I think that's a thing that our picks have in common there, Kelly, is that we both prefer the Dark Knight detective version of Batman.
Yeah.
That seems to be where we're leaning. And I think maybe there's a reason for that. Like, we're the fantastical and like weird, crazy elements that Batman can sometimes find himself in, they're fun for a little while, but they're not like enduring or endearing as as the detective, like the noir type character that that we prefer. Now, Kelly, I remember buying Batman number one from you, and like both of us kind of like being really into how Batman was going in the New 52. So, how did the Court of Owls strike you whenever you took a look at it?
I think I felt in a lot of way. I mean, the way you pretty much laid it out really, really well with the way you described it. That's how I felt about it myself. It was just a really well crafted story that, I mean, as far as stories go, Scott Snyder just had a really, his complete run with Batman, I think, has been highly, it's been thought of very highly. I mean, he had a really, really terrific run on that series. And this whole Court of Owls brought in this whole new series of characters, background information on Gotham. They did more world building with the Bat mythos and Gotham and everything. And I love it when they do things like that, where they take something and they add to it. And, it doesn't always work, but when it does like this, it just really, it makes everything, it just adds so much more to the Bat history and the Bat franchise, I guess. I mean, I enjoyed it. I think if you look at again, I hate to mention this because I know what Russell's going to say, but I think they're even using pieces of the Court of Owls in the current Gotham.
Hashtag Gotham season. Sucks.
Sorry, Miranda. I mean, I'm trying to throw a little bit out there, but
oh, that doesn't look like the Court of Owls to me. It looks like Dr. Hurt.
Well. They're trying.
It is the Court of Owls and their mythos, but
they're
I'll be happy about one thing: Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo getting paid, because that's their creation, and that means that somebody's got to cut them a check. So if they're going to use it on Gotham, hey, cool. That I'm sure they're happy about it. I mean, even if it's not done well, they're like, we're getting paid, and. I mean, the vastly superior version of the Court of Owls is in comics. But, hey, but I'll throw a little olive branch out there. Okay, you like Gotham? That's fine. And if you think the Court of Owls is intriguing on Gotham, you absolutely need to check out how they were in the comics. Because their story is one of the single most intriguing things that's been added to the Batman mythos in recent memory. And, I mean, it's been a long time since we've had something added to Batman that I could genuinely say had real staying power. I mean, there have been plenty of villains that have been played with, plenty of like little one-shot stuff that just, didn't take, didn't even stick around. And I think that the Court of Owls is one of those things that could absolutely have that kind of staying power. They've shown up, pretty steadily along since Snyder and Capullo's first arc. And their ties to Gotham City, plus their ties to like directly to the Wayne family, really builds a type of mystery that seems like it would be obvious, It seems like something that would be obvious to do, but nobody had ever tried it before. Yeah. This idea that Bruce doesn't know his city as well as he thinks he does. And one of the best things that Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo did in their entire run was to make Gotham City feel like a living, breathing character. They didn't forget that Gotham is as much an influence over these characters as they are over each other. So that's what makes the Court of Owls a big standout. But it does help to know a little bit more about Bruce's history, because like Hush, you get a hodgepodge appearance of many different Batman villains, but also callbacks to some things from his past. the multiple Robins. It helps to know a little bit more about the character before you just dive into the Court of Owls. But once you get there, you will absolutely love that series, and pretty much all of Scott Snyder's run. But there are other there are plenty of other good stories out there, and one character we haven't really touched on too much is Joker, but I think he's got a story that needs to be talked about.
Yeah, that would be my my other pick would be the Killing Joke, which it's definitely a dark Joker story. And it, I remember, you know, there's a few times in my comic book reading past where I have read a series and have been emotionally impacted in such a way that I felt almost kind of nauseous. This is one of those. This is one of those stories. I remember reading it the first time, and literally, it affected me that way. I was literally like nauseated after I read it and put it down. I was like, "Oh my God, that was just." And it was a good story, but it was a very sad story. And that, I mean, in a lot of ways. And I really don't want to get into the details of it because it's so worth reading and experiencing it for the first time and getting that impact. It's a very heart-wrenching story. And like I said, it's to me, I think it's probably the best Joker story for me. I mean, you really get to understand that, you know, a lot of people take – and like myself, I did too. I really took the Joker as just this comic clown character that, yeah, he's done some rough things, but here he just goes to a whole different level. And after that, I never looked at the Joker the same. I literally was like, oh, you know, fuck this guy. You know, I mean, that's literally how I felt about him. I was like, fuck you.
I mean, there's that story is definitely one that feels like afterwards there's no way you can see a redemption path for Joker.
No.
There is none that exists after that. But to fully appreciate the Killing Joke, I think you absolutely do have to know a good bit about the history of Joker and Batman. Like, you have to have experienced the things that went on between them prior to this to kind of get an idea of, you know, why they are where they are.
Yeah, that's why I have it like in kind of the experience column of Batman readership was that, you know, if you're a pretty savvy, experienced Batman reader, then this is a story you've got to read. I mean, you have to because it's you know, it's on the syllabus. It's required reading. I mean,
and that's probably how the best way to think about these books in the more experienced reader list is, you know, these are the books that if you're going to say that you're a Batman fan, this should be required reading. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first books in the opening segment and the opening part, yeah, sure, that's a good place for you to start, and it could make you a fan. But if you're going to be, you know, in it for the long haul, there are certain required reading books, and I think that Killing Joke is absolutely one of those. But it's steeped in all that history, and it's not just the history between Batman and Joker. It's also Batman and Jim Gordon's history, mm-hmm. and the history of Barbara Gordon. Like you got to know. I mean, it helps with the emotional impact of it. It's not that you can't understand what's going on in the story if you don't know all that. It's that the emotional impact of the story is lessened if you haven't experienced more of that history.
Yeah.
So, especially the ending.
Yeah. I mean, it's it's a very, like I said, it's a very intense read. And, you know, I've read it a few, I've reread it a few times, and it's very, it's very telling that I still feel kind of the same way after putting it down and reading it. I still feel, may not have that nauseated feeling I had that when after I first read it, just from, you know, the initial shock, but there's this whole real sense of just, it's very emotional after I've read it, you know, after I've reread it a few times over the years. I have this kind of emotional tinge where I'm like, ugh. You know, it's just, and it's good to have stories do that. Like I said, I've had a few stories that has pulled my emotional heartstrings, and like I said, that was one of them, you know. And it's definitely like Russell said, it's you got to read it. If you haven't read it, if you're a fan of Batman and you've read a lot of stuff and you're pretty well versed, go get this. This is back in printing, by the way. It's been back a few years, but for a while it was out of printing. It was kind of hard to find, but they've put it back in. I think in a $19.99 priced hardcover, which is great for a hardcover. I mean, that's a good price for a hardcover.
I mean, it's one of the most popular. It's probably the most popular Joker story out there. Pretty safe bet that you'll be able to find a copy of it.
Oh yeah,
and definitely recommend that you read the book. And if somebody says, "Hey, let's watch the animated movie," just don't.
I haven't seen it, but I've heard I heard that it was just don't, like you said.
Yeah,
so
I. Just go read the graphic novel. You'll be doing yourself a favor. You'll get more out of it. It's more impactful, I think. I think the art was done better in the book. But as far as seminal classics go, I think the one that sticks out for me is the one that everybody always references. And, I mean, everybody knows about this book. And if you don't by now, I mean, where have you been? Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns. That is a seminal classic. It is a book that has been in continuous print since they put it out. It is one of the single most influential works on Batman ever. It may be the most influential Batman book ever. It's certainly the most popular selling Batman graphic novel of the last 30 years. So much so that it's influenced nearly every film take on Batman since 1989. And this is a, you know, on the surface, it's exactly what the story says. It's exactly what the title says it is. Bruce Wayne has retired from being Batman for years. But he has watched Gotham City and pretty much the nation around him just degrade further and further. Like, society is just getting worse and worse and worse, and he can't take it anymore, and he comes back to be Batman to try and turn things around. But his way of doing things is a bit more brutal this time, because he's dealing with a more brutal type of adversary. And of course, when Batman comes back, some of his old villains are going to come back out the woodwork too. And he's going to wind up running afoul of some of his old friends, including Superman, who gets a bit of an ass whooping in this story.
Yeah.
And if you guys saw Batman v Superman, it's even more brutal than that. That was a toned down version of that that ass whipping. Speaking of adaptation versions, this is actually one where I say, if you want to go watch the animated movie adaptation of it, yes, Yes, actually, go do that. And read the book. Because they're very close to one another. They did a two-part movie for The Dark Knight Returns. And it's done incredibly well. They actually captured the art style of Frank Miller way better than I expected. It's got a bit of a political theme to it as well. I mean, it was released back in the mid-80s. So it was during the Reagan years. And you get the sense that Frank Miller was not a big Reagan fan.
Oh, really?
No, no, no. It doesn't strike
Reagan,
me.
Reaganomics?
No.
Come on.
Yeah. Maybe Frank was a bit more of a fan of it, although he did take a symbol of Reagan and quite literally beat it into a bloody pulp.
Yeah.
So there's that. But, you know, that's the classic Batman story to read, I think. It captures many of the classic tropes, especially the modern tropes that we understand about Batman are on full display. But he has it's edgier, it's harder, it's grittier, it's even darker than most Batman stories, even of the time or even since that have done that. But if you read this story and take it in the context of there had never been a Batman story quite like this before, and then you go and read books that like Batman stories that came after it, you can very clearly pull the influence out. I mean, you can see it. It's all over all of these pages. So I can't recommend that book enough, and I can't recommend that you don't read any of its sequels. Now, granted, I haven't read DK3, The Master Race. It may be good. And that may be largely thanks to Brian Azzarello, who we'll talk more about in a minute. But I can't really suggest that you read The Dark Knight Strikes again. I can recommend that you don't waste your money on it, and you don't waste any of your time, and just... And if you really want to go back to that world, just reread The Dark Knight Returns again. You'll be much happier.
Yeah, I...
Because that's... That's kind of the thing with Frank Miller, isn't it? He goes a little bit off the rails.
Frank either hits it right out of the park, or he... You know... Like you said, goes right off the rails. I just keep going back to him and Jim Lee's All-Star Batman and Robin, and just what a dumpster fire that was. Just, I mean,
I'm the goddamn Batman indeed.
Yeah, I just, when I read that line, I wanted to go, are you for real? Is this? You suck. You're sucking so bad right now. And, you know, the other thing too is that that book cost me so much money at my shop, because it was a, you know, a lot of folks were anticipating it. They, you know, came out of the woodwork to get it. And then, my God, people started realizing what a dumpster fire it was, and just was dropping it off their pull list. And I mean, I frantically tried to go in and adjust my order so that I wasn't going to be dumped with all of these issues that I couldn't sell. I mean,
and that is the legacy of All-Star Batman, which we will avoid talking about any further, because but there's one other book that we should mention before we move on to the deeper cuts. So let's very quickly, Kelly, tell them about what's one more piece of slightly more experienced reading they should get into.
I think the other one would be a story arc called A Lonely Place of Dying, which is my favorite, above all, my favorite Batman story. I mean, Killing Joke is up there too, but this one's a lot less hitting you in the gut. This one is really a good tale of telling. I mean, it introduces Tim Drake and his rise to become the third Robin. And to me, the overall what you really should look at for this story arc is, you know, this is why Batman needs Robin. This is why, you know, the Dark Knight needs a sidekick. And this story really drills that home and really and just does it in such a good way. I mean, Tim Drake is one, I think, you know, next to Dick Grayson is probably my favorite Robin. No offense to, you know, my mind just went blank. Red Hood.
Well, there are a few Jason Todd fans out there who Jason might take exception to you forgetting the name of their favorite Robin.
I am sorry. You know, it is late for me a little bit here. I have had a long day at work. So for those Jason Todd fans, please forgive me. It was not intentional. I wasn't, you know, let me make a quick statement here.
You son of a bitch.
I was totally against letting the public choose his fate back in the day when you could call up. You know, it was just a gimmick, and I thought it was poorly done and should never have been done. I think it's poor writing when you let the public make some sort of decision like this. And but you know,
something that again, comic book again, companies could learn from today.
Yeah, but there again, you know what? If it hadn't happened, we wouldn't have the Jason Todd we have today, which is a phenomenal character.
And that's thanks largely to the people who followed it up.
Yeah. But in, you know, going back to A Lonely Place of Dying, it's Tim Drake's show. And he, you know, he figures out who Batman is, figures out it's Bruce, and starts pursuing this whole thing about, hey, you need a Robin. And to me, in a lot of ways, I'm like, God, this Tim Drake character, I mean, this guy could grow up. He could be Batman. He's just as savvy as the detective as Bruce is. And it just really, I really just enjoyed Tim Drake, which is such a really cool character. And like I said, I liked the whole premise of the fact that this really showed you that Batman does need a Robin, to keep him kind of grounded, to keep him kind of from going over to, I guess, you know, a more ruthless kind of person, which he could be. And I don't know. It just, to me, it was one of those stories, excuse me, that I remember when I read the first time. I was like, man, this was another really good Batman story arc that I, you know, jumped on and read all the way through the end. And that's, you know, back in the day, sometimes I didn't always finish up series. Sometimes I would, you know, but this one kept me the entire time.
And I'm right there with you on A Lonely Place of Dying and its follow-up, Robin, A Hero Reborn. Those two stories together are an absolute tour de force of the on the concept of the Robin character, and not so much the character, but the identity of Robin and why it's important to Batman. And I think you nailed it right there. It's like it tells you exactly why Batman needs a Robin, and it makes the strongest case possible that Tim Drake is the ideal Robin.
He's definitely the heir apparent. I mean, and we saw that come to pass a few years ago.
In the stories that followed the death of Bruce Wayne, like Batman Reborn, like Tim tried to be Batman because Dick Grayson was refusing to do it.
Yeah.
And damn near gets himself killed in the process because he wasn't ready to be Batman.
He at least got in there and tried. And that to me was, hey, you know.
Yeah, to me, seems like that character who, like, one day this kid is going to grow up. One day he's going to be Batman. It makes the most sense to make him Batman because Dick Grayson has become Nightwing, and that is his identity. I think it's gotten to the point now where more people associate Dick Grayson as being Nightwing than him being Robin.
Yeah.
Because Dick Grayson does not need the Batman identity. Jason Todd has become very effective as Red Hood, almost as effective as Dick Grayson as Nightwing.
Yeah.
So, but I'm looking over at Tim Drake, and they tried to call him Red Robin. Let's say it together now. Yum. it's a goofy name for the character, but at the same time, he's still a fantastic character when he's written well, and he's been done very well in the most recent run of Detective Comics. So if you guys haven't been reading that, go find Detective Comics 934. Start there and go forward. Tim Drake is awesome in it, as is every character in that book. It's beautifully done. But that story, A Lonely Place of Dying, tells you a great origin of Tim Drake. So I'm right there with you. But we got to move on pretty quickly here to our next few segments, and we'll try to get through them a little faster this time. Because some of you out there, you know Batman's history, and you may have even heard of some of these stories we're going to mention, but if you've never tried out some of these, this is for those people who've been reading Batman for years, and maybe you want something a little different. And one book I'm going to recommend to you is going to be Batman Broken City. It's a story that came right after Hush, was glossed over, more or less, because it wasn't the big flashy summer blockbuster type show that Hush was. It's by Brian Azzarello and Eduardo Risso, who some of you comic book fans out there will know is the award-winning creative team behind 100 Bullets, which is a very gritty noir story that was done through DC's Mature Readers imprint, Vertigo. And when these two took over Batman, they went very murder mystery with it, made it very dark and gritty. And one of the things that I found intriguing about it was its lack of color. It uses color in the story, but everything is much more bleak. Heavy use of reds and oranges throughout. Red, orange, and yellow is a big thing in the book. And if you liked, say, Sin City, that's kind of the tone of this story. It's almost like Batman meets Sin City. If you released Batman into Sin City, how would that go? Broken City kind of has that thing going on with it. But what I really like most is that they write, or Brian Azzarello writes Batman a little closer to how Frank Miller writes him. You know, and I think that maybe that's why Brian Azzarello got the gig working on a DK3 was because he can get into that similar headspace where you've got a Batman who's a little unhinged, a little off his rocker. You start to see that side of the character coming out more so than you did like in the story arc before it. So that's one that I would recommend. Kelly, what would you tell somebody who's looking for a deeper cut?
I think mine was a story that was called Son of the Demon. And this was a Grant Morrison story, if I remember right.
Grant Morrison did something with it. I think that was
He did something with it after the fact. But this is a story that basically tells you the – it's basically the first appearance and origin kind of Damian Wayne, and sets him up to become, you know, down the road through Grant Morrison, the character we have today.
Yeah, he's not called Damian Wayne in this story. He never has a name.
No. He never has a name, but I mean this was a book that technically wasn't in canon, but then down the road it became part of canon.
By Mike Barr and Jerry Bingham. Yeah, you're right. Originally it was an Elseworlds title.
An Elseworlds-related book.
But Grant Morrison decided to take it and run with it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's tell the people about it. What's Son of the Demon about?
Like I said, basically it is the Bruce and Talia come together and they conceive a child there's a lot more going on, but I mean that's the base essentials of what the story was. And she ends up telling Bruce, hey, I lost the baby. He goes back, but really, you know, she has the child and just did that to further, you know, further her agenda and so forth. But I mean, it's really cool that this was a story that was an Elseworld story that just was thrown out there, was done, was really... You know, Elseworld was essentially the series line of Elseworld was is technically their What If line, like with the way Marvel had their What If. You know, this is essentially Elseworlds are kind of their What Ifs. And this is, you know, a story that they did. And later on, it became canon because of things that were, you know, let's bring in Bruce's son. Let's establish him in the DCU. And, it's just a good story. I mean, like I said, it's really one of those books like we're talking about that this is for established expert, you know, Batman fans. This is, you know, one of those stories that doesn't get a lot of attention anymore, but really it's worth the read. It's worth going back and reading.
Yeah, and that's kind of how I feel about my next pick, because it's one that doesn't get talked about a lot, but it's not an Elseworlds title. This is an in-canon, or at least in the pre-Flashpoint days. This is the one of my favorite in-canon Batman stories, called Batman Face the Face by James Robinson and Don Kramer. After Infinite Crisis, DC jumped ahead 1 year, and this was the first Batman story that they published after that, because for a year Batman and Robin had left Gotham City to kind of retrace Batman's steps, like how he became what he is. And they did that in an effort to become better at being who they are, to be a better team and to just be a better Batman and Robin. And in that time, Batman had left Gotham City in the care of Harvey Dent, who seemed to be cured of being Two-Face. But when Batman comes back to Gotham, several of his his B and C list villains wind up being murdered, and in ways that suggest that Two-Face was responsible for it. So that mystery builds and builds and builds. A lot of misdirection. Fantastic artwork from Kramer. I think that's one of the best looking Batman books that I think has been put out there. And of course, James Robinson has a really great voice for Bruce and for Harvey. So it's one of those books that really pulls you in. You get sucked into the characters and just want to keep going with it. But it plays heavy on the relationship between Bruce and Harvey. So if you hadn't been familiarized yourself with that, then some of the emotional beats and some of the character beats in this might not mean much. But if you have a long history with those two characters and you love Two-Face like I do, then this is a book that you need to go and pick up. Should still be able to find that one in trade, but if not, I know that it's out there in digital form. So Batman Face-to-Face would be my absolute next one. So Kelly, which one would you? What else would you recommend? I think you got a couple of Elseworlds titles that you'd recommend.
I think all of my deeper cuts are Elseworlds. The other one was Thrill Killer, which is an Elseworld again, an Elseworld story. In this version, Bruce Wayne's parents were murdered by their servants, and Bruce pretty much is left with not a whole lot, and ends up, you know, having to sell the possessions, the house. He ends up selling them to Barbara Gordon, and she ends up, he kind of goes the route of becoming, I mean, he enlists and becomes becomes a police officer, and she ends up kind of taking the Batman route, and she ends up even getting a man, not a boy, version of Robin, you know, to kind of be her sidekick. And it's just a really, I mean, just a really interesting read. I mean, because it's completely, you know, taking a lot of the characters and kind of, you know, twisting them and you know, turning them on their head. You know, because Bruce is wearing, you know, he's wearing a gold shield. He's a cop. There's a two-faced cop that, you know, of course, is Harvey Dent, and he's doing his shtick. There's a female Joker in this version of Batman. It's just there's just a lot going on. And I think it was three issues long, which most Elseworld stories were kind of one and done. But there were a few later on as they became more popular, they started doing kind of like a three-parter situation. And like I said, it's one of those books that doesn't, it's kind of it's under the radar. It didn't really hit real big, but it's definitely one that everybody that has read it has really, really liked it. I think it's one that if you're a Batman fan, that it's definitely something you should check out.
Yeah, and hopefully that one will get collected in some of the Batman Elseworlds titles that are being collected now.
I think it's going to be.
I hope so. It hasn't been listed in any of the three that have been solicited so far. But I would think that it'd be really hard to not put that one in a fourth volume whenever that comes out. Hopefully that will be in there, because I would like to read that story. I've never read it, so I would love to read Thrill Killer. My last deep pick would be one of my absolute favorite Batman stories ever. It is a proper sequel to Hush called Heart of Hush by Paul Dini and Dustin Nguyen. And if you recognize the name Paul Dini, he's one of the lead writers of Batman the Animated Series. And this is his spin on the Hush character. So basically, this is a revenge story. There's no real, like, mystery to this. This is Hush's revenge. This is him coming back after the initial story arc, and then, of course, his unmentionable, unreadable Hush Returns, which, yeah, don't even bother. They'll tell you everything you need to know about that in Heart of Hush. But this gets into that deeper psychosis side of the character. Like, how obsessive can Hush get? Pretty much on the same level as Batman. Batman has an obsessive personality. So does Hush. And on top of that, Hush is a planner and a master of the long game, a master of human chess. And he plays it probably on the same level as Batman. But I don't want to give up too much of this story, but this is one of those books that it's as gorgeous as it is fun to read. Hush is reestablished as one of Batman's most threatening villains. He is manipulative. He is incredibly smart. He's just a, in my book, like he gets as close to being like a perfect foil for Batman. He's like the anti-Batman, if you will. And this story establishes him, like further establishes him as that. So, it's one of those that I highly recommend you read. And then if you can get your hands on the, trade volumes of Streets of Gotham, which follow up this story, and they're also written by Paul Dini and drawn by Dustin Nguyen. I highly recommend you go get those and just discover how great the character of Hush can be whenever he's written well. And Paul Dini is the guy that has written him as close to on the same level as what Jeff Loeb did. So that is my final deep cut pick.
Nice.
So, Kelly, you've got one more, I think, that you wanted to recommend to the people, and it's a classic.
It is a classic. And I'm going to go ahead and just do this very briefly and kind of, I mean, there's not a whole lot I want to get into because this is a really good story, and I don't want to give out a whole lot of details, but it's Gotham by Gaslight. And, again, it's an Elseworld book, and it's kind of like kind of Batman versus the Jack, kind of versus the Jack the Ripper kind of story. And that's really what I want to just kind of say that I'm not going to say a whole lot more about it, but I mean, it's a really good story. I would say that most of the Elseworld books, the early ones that they did, on Batman and, of course, you know, the other characters, were really well done. I'm really disappointed that they have not really ever gone back to doing Elseworld books, because it was really a good idea that they did. I mean, they came up with this idea of kind of taking a character and kind of spinning them around, and I think in a lot of ways that even to this day, I think Elseworld would still work in this day and time for comics. Would love to see them kind of reestablish it. Doesn't have to be an ongoing series. It never was. It was just kind of they would do these ever so often. And I think that's why they were so good, is because they didn't really have to churn them out month after month, you know, so they had time to kind of give these ideas up and have these writers come in. Well, hey, I have this idea for an Elseworld book, you know?
Yeah. And that's something that I wouldn't mind seeing a return to that too, is doing a little more Elseworld stuff. And there's plenty of audience out there that would love it.
They
would absolutely buy that. Cause I mean, they buy stories that are outside of continuity all the time. I mean, the Earth One line is a pretty big seller. But that kind of brings us to the end of the comics portion, and we've really gone way over the time allotted. But real quickly, we're going to kind of go over some TV shows and movies that you guys should check out if you're looking to get into Batman. And not going to get too heavy into this, but I am going to go ahead and say that some people were not happy about our bottom five live-action comic book TV shows podcast because Batman 66 was on it. And I still stand by it as being one of the worst live-action adaptation comic book shows of all time. However, if you are looking for something lighthearted and fun after all this darkness that we have thrown at you, because it has been a long, dark trail of Batman in all these stories we've mentioned, and you want something that's a satire, something that totally makes fun of the idea of Batman and like turns it on its ear, but also gives you some pretty fun versions of each of Batman's rogues gallery, I would say go check out that 1966 Adam West and Burt Ward TV show. DC has actually done, or excuse me, Warner Brothers Television has released a complete series Blu-ray of it recently. And there's a new animated movie coming up called Batman Return of the Caped Crusader that's based in that world. So I highly recommend you check that out. It's certainly a series that made an impression on me as a kid. I think, Kelly, you mentioned to me that there was an animated TV show that was based off that, too, called, I believe it was The New Adventures of Batman.
Yeah, that's one that I would recommend if you're a fan of the TV series, the live action series. You need to watch. You need to look up Batman, The New Adventures of Batman, because Burt Ward and
Mayor Adam West.
Adam West.
he's not a mayor or anything except Quahog.
Quahog. But they reprise their roles, lending their voices to their animated counterparts. And I remember, again, another shout-out to the 70s, watching this on CBS every Saturday morning. It was a very funny, very entertaining show. So, I mean, I that's definitely one that I would recommend.
Yeah, and because sometimes it's good to laugh at Batman, and Batman can be very funny. There are plenty of funny concepts within that, and there's another more modern show that you also mentioned loving that has that
yes.
that funniness, that funny element to it. What was that one?
That is Batman Brave and the Bold. The very first episode, I want to say, I could be wrong, but or at least the first episode I ever saw of this series. Of course, if any of you out there have seen the series, you know that Brave and the Bold always started like there's something already, you know, there's already an adventure going on, and you watch like 2 or 3 minutes of it before the show starts, and it's always some other character Batman's hanging out with. It's not the one that's actually he's teaming up with that episode. And I'm sitting there and I'm watching it, and I see on the screen, and probably the only time we'll ever see this character on the screen ever, a character named Bawana Beast. Again, a very C-level. I know him because I have a thing for oddball characters. I saw him, and my friend at the time, my friend Chris was watching it with me, and I went, "Oh my God, Bawana Beast is!" And I flip out, and he is like, "I've never seen you get so excited over someone who is so lame." And I was like, "But he's on. They put him in a cartoon, you know." And it was funny. It was funny for me. But it's a good series. I mean, it's got the team ups, the characters they have that they pull into the show is absolutely spot on. And to me, they've got the very best Aquaman ever in a cartoon. I mean, this Aquaman is. He's it, folks. I mean, and if you ever watch it, you ever see it, you'll know what I'm talking about.
He is. I have actually seen that bit of Brave and the Bold, and I will say that, yeah, that is a really entertaining show, and one, if you're again, looking for a good laugh, then that is the Batman for you. It's a kind of a modern spin on the idea of Batman 66, but taking a gruffer Batman. And putting him in it. But anyway, another show, a final TV show that I think you and I both absolutely agree on, and I think it would be a crime not to mention it.
Oh, yeah.
Batman, the animated series from the 1990s. It was the Bruce Timm, Paul Dini, written and produced an animated series that took a lot of cues from the Tim Burton film. But also just, like, in some cases, straight-up adapted Batman stories right out of the comics and onto the page. And in other cases, reinvented some of Batman's supporting cast in Rogues Gallery, as well as was the origin point for DC's now most popular character, Harley Quinn.
Oh, yeah.
She made her debut... and Batman the Animated Series. This show also gave us what I consider to be the definitive takes on Two-Face, the Riddler, and of course, the infamous and just maniacally wonderful Joker, voiced by Mark Hamill.
Yeah.
And for an entire for multiple generation of kids, Kevin Conroy is the voice of Batman. And if you watch this show, you will see why. And if you have Amazon Prime, you can stream the entire series right now. All four seasons. All available. I highly recommend you do that. It is a beautiful, perfect intro to Batman, to his world. You'll be immersed in it. You'll be intrigued. It gives you mystery stories. It has horror stories. It has comedy. It has some of the most outlandish stuff, but I mean, at all at once, the entire time you're watching it, you will walk away from that series saying, that's Batman. That is the definitive Batman. So
yeah.
Go get on that. But and before we get out of here, we're going to mention a couple movies that you guys should absolutely be watching. Now, normally, we would have gone like straight up, like, would it be live action or would it be cartoons? But we just said, you know what, let's say screw it and say what movies would we tell people to go watch? So, Kelly, if there's, you know, what's your personal pick for a Batman movie that people should go watch?
I would say the 89 Batman.
Is it your number one a movie?
Yes. Yes, I think that
it makes Kelly that, hot under the collar.
It just was a good movie. It made a lot of people. I knew a lot of folks that weren't Batman fans. They became Batman fans, and you know, started reading comics and specifically Batman comics because of that film. And so I remember going and seeing it in the theater. It was a really, you know, it was a fun experience. So I mean, I highly recommend it. I really think it's like almost required if you're a Batman fan. You should at least see it.
Yeah, Jack Nicholson's Joker steals that show. Michael Keaton was a very effective Batman, and of course, you can't say enough about the Danny Elfman score. And the music from Prince, which is absolutely perfect. That museum scene and the parade at the end will never cease to be amazing to me. I watch those whenever I'm feeling down. I just plug that up and I feel better. As crazy as the stuff that's happening in those scenes is, it's just classic. Like, you can't watch it and not smile. Because it's just everything that a fun maniacal version of Joker should be. And speaking of like maniacal crazy versions of Joker, my pick would be an animated movie. Actually, I think people should go and check out the animated version of Batman Under the Red Hood, which is based on a Batman story of similar name. It was called Under the Hood whenever it was in comics, and that was written by Judd Winnick. But this movie is the animated version of that tale that tells the return of Jason Todd, long thought dead, but returned to the living through use of a Lazarus pit by Ra's al Ghul. And when he comes back, he's none too happy about the idea that Batman never did anything about Joker murdering him. And of course, Red Hood decides to start going after crime, but he does it in a bit more Punisher-esque kind of way. A way that Batman doesn't exactly approve of, but at the same time, Batman also feels kind of responsible for his existence. It's a deeply personal and emotional story, and it was so beautifully rendered in movie form. And the reason I recommend the movie over the comic is because I felt like the movie was more coherent and isn't so steeped in a lot of crazy Batman lore that you would absolutely have to go and read up on and understand to be able to get what where the story was coming from in the comics. The comic also ties into Infinite Crisis, which is a great story. But again, steeped in some heavy DC lore, so you might want to know your stuff before you just dive into that. But as far as the movie's concerned, no, it's very accessible. But Kelly, you had an animated movie too, didn't you?
Yeah. Mine was based on a comic book story done in the Superman Batman series called Public Enemies.
Jeff Loeb comes back again.
Yeah. And it's, again, it's one of those, if you've read the series, you're going to enjoy this too, because it really takes a lot from the comic. It really does pull a lot from it. And, you know, it's a really cool story with Batman and Superman kind of being in this precarious situation that they're in. And, there are other characters that are a part of the story. You've got Captain Atom that's in it, and who's another favorite of mine.
Captain Marvel's in there.
Captain Marvel's in there.
So yep. Is Hawkman.
So is Hawkman, yeah.
They actually have a really great desert fight scene. Superman and Batman versus Captain Marvel and Hawkman. Tremendous scene, both in the comic and the movie. And it's unlike Batman v Superman. This is a story of Superman and Batman very much getting along.
I mean,
they rib each other a little bit, but it's fun. It's funny. It's good dialogue. And this is absolutely where I think people should go for that type of thing. Like, if you want to see some of that banter back and forth between Superman and Batman, that's a good choice, Kelly. I like that.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm going to go with the seminal classic. I won't go too much into this, but it ties into Batman the Animated Series, and it was Batman Mask of the Phantasm. It's the one time in Batman the Animated Series where we get more of Bruce's history. Like, we see who he is, why he is, and we see that that background on him, like his lead up to becoming Batman. It also introduces a really interesting new villain in the Phantasm, who I feel like hasn't gotten nearly enough play in comics or in television since.
Yeah, I agree.
But that was a good character, and one that I really wish would be followed up on. But it's a great mystery story, and of course it also features some classic turns from Mark Hamill as the Joker. Killer performances, one of the most emotional stories that I've seen, and surprisingly, it's short on action, but it's heavy on heart. You know, it's a heavy story, but done very well. And I think we both agree, though, on one thing. The absolute best story, the best Batman movie ever made. And I think we both have to say that it's The Dark Knight from Christopher Nolan.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yep.
It don't get better than that, folks. In terms of acting, character portrayal, say what you will about gruff Batman voice, it's still the definitive take on that character, and I think in a lot of people's mind, the definitive take on Joker. I mean, Heath Ledger won an Oscar, and I think he would have won the Oscar even if he hadn't died. I think that this is a performance that will last forever. It will go down in the annals of history as one of the all-time greatest performances ever seen on screen.
Yeah.
So I
agree. That's you said it all. I mean, that's a great, you know, great movie.
And it's a fun ride as long as it is, and it does get long. But what a ride it is, and it never lets up. It's one of those that's like, man, this is over 2.5 hours long, but it doesn't feel like it. And I gotta say, the expert direction from Christopher Nolan is just, I think that was when he really hit his true stride, was in that movie. He'd done really good movies up to then, but whenever he did, after The Dark Knight, everything after that has just been top-notch filmmaking. I mean, everything from Inception to Interstellar. It don't get better than that, folks. You go watch The Dark Knight. I'm pretty sure everybody listening to this has probably seen The Dark Knight multiple times, but if you are one of those few people who hasn't, come on, man. Go watch that movie immediately. Now, before we cut it off, I do have to say that we forgot to mention one other book at the beginning in our first timers section, because we did give Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo some praise, but we forgot to mention that they also did a take on Batman's origin. Called Batman Zero Year. Now I know what some of you are thinking. You're like, oh my god, what a stupid name, because I mean, year one, how are you going to go 0 year? Well, you know what, get past it. Like, get past that, because that's really not the important part, even though that name actually makes sense once you start reading the story. And that's something that Snyder's an expert at. Like, you may think that story sounds dumb, or that name doesn't sound right, but as soon as you start reading his stuff, it becomes clear. And Zero Year, unlike Batman Year One, did some crazy pulpy things with Batman, as well as doing the lead up to a darker take on the character. And it's also a great place to get introductions to pretty much all of Batman's major villains. Through the three story arcs that it encompassed, which were Secret City, Dark City, and Savage City, you get introduced to the likes of Penguin, Edward Nygma, you get kind of sort of origins for Jim Gordon, and even Dr. Death and Poison Ivy. These are characters that are kind of essential to Batman's world. So I highly recommend going and checking that series out. You'll find it listed usually as Batman Volume 4, and I know that's going to sound a little crazy. Like, why would I start at Volume 4? But if you're looking to read in linear order, that would probably be a good way to go. So Batman Zero Year definitely deserves a shout-out, and I feel bad for leaving it out at the beginning. So with that said, that kind of brings us to the end of our guide to Batman. We hope that we've been able to help you clear a path for yourself through some Batman reading. We will definitely be doing some more of these guide to segments. We're going to try and keep them a little shorter next time, I think. But we had a lot to talk about with Batman, because there's just so much out there.
Yeah, it's you can't really shortcut this character very much. So yeah, it's
and we did take some shortcuts, because I know we left some stuff out that people are probably going to be like, ah, what about this story, what about that story, what about Danny O'Neill's The Laughing Fish? That's a fantastic story. Yeah, and you're right, that is a definitive Batman story, one that I would put in the slightly more experienced reader section. But in this case we didn't go so much for definitive as we went for our personal favorites. So these, It's a little bit different twist on this. But I think we're going to be doing a couple more of these pretty soon. The next one of these won't be until December. And we're going to be welcoming back our nemesis/cohort, Mr. Greg Phillips from the Hard Traveling Fanboys, is going to be joining us on the next time we do one of these Guide to episodes, whenever we do the Guide to Superman.
Awesome.
Which should be a tremendous episode. Very much looking forward to that. But, Kelly, it's October.
Yeah, it is.
That means Halloween. We got to do something. We got to do something for the people for Halloween. And we know exactly what we're doing. Our next episode, guys, when you come back, and you know you need to, we are going to debut the very first time ever on Sellers Points, our new segment, The Missed and the Maligned. Our look at books or movies or TV shows that maybe people skipped and shouldn't have, or maybe take, you know, big, huge dumps on and shouldn't. Or maybe they should. Maybe we'll take a look at some books that are maligned and say, you know what? They definitely should be. Or we'll take a look at a book that should have been, that was skipped, and we'll be like, you know what? I'd get it. But in this particular case, we're going to be taking a look at one of our personal favorites, a collection of miniseries from Dark Horse called Beasts of Burden. By Evan Dorkin and Jill Thompson. It's one of the single best minis ever. Kelly, I can't wait to talk about that book with you.
I can't either. I just reread. A good friend of mine, Joe, brought me his copy of Beast of Burden and Hellboy. They're one shot, and I reread that this past week and. Didn't reread. I mean, I read it for the first time. I'm going to reread Beast of Burden to get it, you know, more familiarized in my head. But that story with Hellboy was just phenomenal. It was just a good, strong story. And
I think our good friend Miranda might be able to help you out. She mentioned being able to get a copy of that to you pretty soon. So hopefully she will. And please don't hold my hashtag Gotham Sucks against Kelly, Miranda. He's not in on that. That's just me. and the legions and legions of hashtag Gotham Sucks fans on Twitter, definitely hit us up there. You can find me at Russell_Sellers. Kelly, where can people find you on Twitter?
Let me look real quick. I'm sorry, folks.
I forgot his own handle.
Yeah. I mean, it's late for me. It's been a long day. It is kpool at HKP2814 on Twitter.
Yep. You can find him at HKP2814. Nah, he's not a Green Lantern fan at all.
No.
that's crazy talk. I don't know what these people are. I don't know what you're talking about. What's Green Lantern? Anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, folks, you can also email me at russells@placetobenation.com. If you got a suggestion for our Guide To segment, definitely hit us up on Twitter or in my email. Let us know which character or concept that you would like us to do a Guide To episode on. And yes, we will absolutely take any and all user feedback. We are very curious what you guys have to say. Tell us which books you would recommend to any Batman fan, be they new or old. What should they be reading? But for now, thank you guys again for joining us right here on Place to Be Nation Pop. This is the Sellers Points Podcast. I am Russell Sellers for Kelly Poole. We will see you guys next time.
Thank you.